It's hard to reconstruct Smith's reasoning here, but he may have been a victim of the all curves or lines fallacy, reasoning that if buying all the tickets made you certain to lose money, then buying more tickets must make you more likely to lose money. Buying 6 million tickets minimizes the chance of losing money, but that doesn't mean it's the right play. It matters how much money you lose. The one ticket player suffers a near certainty of losing money, but she knows she won't lose a lot. The buyer of 6 million tickets, despite the lower chance of losing, is in a much more dangerous position. And probably you still feel that neither choice seems very wise. As Smith points out, if the lottery is a winning proposition for the state, it seems like it must be a bad idea for whoever takes the other side of the bet. What Smith's argument against lotteries is missing is the notion of expected value, the mathematical formalism that captures the intuition Smith is trying to express. It works like this. Suppose we possess an item whose monetary worth is uncertain, like, say, a lottery ticket. So 9,999,999 out of 10 million times, the ticket is worth nothing, while 1 in 10 million times, the ticket is worth $6 million. Despite our uncertainty, we still might want to assign the ticket a definite value. Why? Well, what if a guy comes around offering to pay $1.20 for people's tickets? Is it wise to make the deal and pocket the 20-cent profit, or should I hold on to my ticket? That depends whether I've assigned the ticket a worth of more or less than $1.20. Here's how you compute the expected value of a lottery ticket. For each possible outcome, you multiply the chance of that outcome by the ticket's value given that outcome. In this simplified case, there are only two outcomes. You lose or you win. So you get 9,999,999 out of 10 million times 0 is 0, while 1 out of 10 million times 6 million is 60 cents. Then you add the results up. 0 plus 60 cents is 60 cents. So the expected value of your ticket is 60 cents. If a lottophile comes to your door and offers $1.20 for your ticket, expected value says you ought to make the deal. In fact, expected value says you shouldn't have paid a dollar for it in the first place. Expected value is not the value you expect. Expected value is another one of those mathematical notions saddled, like significance, with a name that doesn't quite capture its meaning. We certainly don't expect the lottery ticket to be worth 60 cents. On the contrary, it's either worth 10 million clams or zilch, nothing in between. Similarly, suppose I make a $10 bet on a dog I think has a 10% chance of winning its race. If the dog wins, I get $100. If the dog loses, I get nothing. The expected value of the bet is then 10% times $100 plus 90% times 0, which is $10. But this is not, of course, what I expect to happen. Winning $10 is, in fact, not even a possible outcome of my bet, let alone the expected one. A better name might be average value, for what the expected value of the bet really measures is what I'd expect to happen if I made many such bets on many such dogs. Let's say I laid down 1,000 $10 bets like that. I'd probably win about 100 of them, the law of large numbers again, and make $100 each time, totaling 10,000. So my 1,000 bets are returning, on average, $10 per bet. In the long run, you're likely to come out about even. Expected value is a great way to figure out the right price of an object, like a gamble on a dog, whose true value isn't certain. If I pay $12 apiece for those tickets, I'm very likely to lose money in the long run. If I can get them for $8, on the other hand, I should probably buy as many as I can. Hardly anybody plays the dogs anymore, but the machinery of expected value is the same whether you're pricing race tickets, stock options, lottery tickets, or life insurance. The Million Act. The notion of expected value started to come into mathematical focus in the mid-1600s, and by the end of that century, the idea was understood well enough to be used by practical scientists like Edmund Halley, the Astronomer Royal of England. Yep, the comet guy. But he was also one of the first scientists to study the correct pricing of insurance, which in the reign of William III was a matter of critical military importance. England had thrown itself enthusiastically into war on the continent, and war required capital. Parliament proposed to raise the necessary funds via the Million Act of 1692, which aimed to raise £1 million by selling life annuities to the population. Signing up for an annuity meant paying the Crown a lump sum in exchange for a guaranteed lifetime annual payout. This is a kind of life insurance in reverse. Purchasers of such an annuity are essentially betting that they won't die anytime soon. As a measure of the rudimentary state of the actuarial science of the time, the cost of the annuity was set without reference to the annuitant's age. A lifetime annuity for a grandfather, likely to require funding for at most a decade, cost as much as one for a child. Halley was scientist enough to understand the absurdity of the age-independent pricing scheme. He determined to work out a more rational accounting of the value of a lifetime annuity. The difficulty is that people don't arrive and depart on a rigid schedule as comets do. But by using birth and death statistics, Halley was able to estimate the probability of various lifespans for each annuitant, and thereby to compute the expected value of the annuity. He wrote, "It is plain that the purchaser ought to pay for only such a part of the value of the annuity as he has chances that he is living, and this ought to be computed yearly, and the sum of all those yearly values being added together will amount to the value of the annuity for the life of the person proposed." In other words, Grandpa, with his shorter expected lifespan, pays less for an annuity than Junior. It is obvious. Digression. When I tell people the story of Edmund Halley and the price of annuities, I often get interrupted, "But it's obvious that you should charge younger people more." It is not obvious. Rather, it is obvious if you already know it, as modern people do, but the fact that people who administered annuities failed to make this observation again and again is proof that it's not actually obvious. Mathematics is filled with ideas that seem obvious now, that negative quantities can be added and subtracted, that you can usefully represent points in a plane by pairs of numbers, that probabilities of uncertain events can be mathematically described and manipulated, but are in fact not obvious at all. If they were, they would not have arrived so late in the history of human thought. This reminds me of an old story from the Harvard Math Department concerning one of the grand old Russian professors, who we'll call O. Professor O is midway through an intricate algebraic derivation when a student in the back row raises his hand. "Professor O, I didn't follow that last step. Why do those two operators commute?" The professor raises his eyebrows and says, "It is obvious." But the student persists, "I'm sorry, Professor O, I really don't see it." So Professor O goes back to the board and adds a few lines of explanation. "What we must do? Well, the two operators are both diagonalized by... well, it is not exactly diagonalized, but... just a moment." Professor O pauses for a little while, peering at what's on the board and scratching his chin. Then he retreats to his office. About 10 minutes go by. The students are about to start leaving when Professor O returns and again assumes his station in front of the chalkboard. "Yes," he says satisfied, "it is obvious." Don't play Powerball. The nationwide lottery game Powerball is currently playable in 42 U.S. states, the District of Columbia, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. It's extremely popular, sometimes selling as many as 100 million tickets for a single drawing. Poor people play Powerball, and people who are already rich play Powerball. My dad, a former president of the American Statistical Association, plays Powerball, and since he usually gets me a ticket, I guess I've played too. Is this wise? On December 6th, 2013, as I write this, the jackpot stands at a handsome $100 million. And the jackpot isn't the only way to win. Like many lotteries, Powerball features many levels of prizes. The smaller, more frequent prizes help keep people feeling the game's worth playing. With expected value, we can check those feelings against the mathematical facts. Here's how you compute the expected value of a $2 ticket. When you buy that ticket, you're buying a 1 in 175 million chance of a $100 million jackpot, a 1 in 5 million chance of a $1 million prize, a 1 in 650,000 chance of a $10,000 prize, a 1 in 19,000 chance of a $100 prize, a 1 in 12,000 chance of a different $100 prize, a 1 in 700 chance of a $7 prize, a 1 in 360 chance of a different $7 prize, a 1 in 110 chance of a $4 prize, and a 1 in 55 chance of a different $4 prize. You can get all these details from Powerball's website, which also offers a surprisingly spunky frequently asked questions page filled with material like, Question, do Powerball tickets expire? Answer, yes, the universe is decaying and nothing lasts forever. So the expected amount you'll win is 100 million over 175 million, plus 1 million over 5 million, plus 10,000 over 650,000, plus 100 over 19,000, plus 100 over 12,000, plus 7 over 700, plus 7 over 360, plus 4 over 110, plus 4 over 55, which comes to just under 94 cents. In other words, according to expected value, the ticket isn't worth your $2. That's not the end of the story, because not all lottery tickets are the same. When the jackpot is $100 million, as it is today, the expected value of a ticket is scandalously low. But each time the jackpot goes unclaimed, more money enters the prize pool. And the bigger the jackpot gets, the more people buy tickets. And the more people buy tickets, the more likely it is that one of those tickets is going to make somebody a multimillionaire. In August 2012, Donald Lawson, a Michigan railroad worker, took home a $337 million jackpot. When the top prize is that big, the expected value of a ticket gets bigger too. Same computation we just did, but when you swap in the $337 million jackpot, the expected value pops up to $2.29. Suddenly, playing the lottery doesn't seem like such a bad bet after all. How big does the jackpot have to be before the expected value of a ticket exceeds the $2 it costs? Now you can finally go back to your 8th grade math teacher and tell her you figured out what algebra is for. If we call the value of the jackpot J, the expected value of a ticket turns out to be J over 175 million plus 36.7 cents. Now here comes the algebra. For the expected value to be more than the $2 you spent, you need J over 175 million to be bigger than $1.63 or so. Multiplying both sides by 175 million, you find that the threshold value of the jackpot is a little over $285 million. That's not a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence. The pot got that big 3 times in 2012. So it sounds like the lottery might be a good idea after all, if you're careful to play only when the jackpot gets high enough. But that's not the end of the story either. You are not the only person in America who knows algebra. And even people who don't know algebra instinctively understand that a lottery ticket is more enticing when the jackpot is 300 million than when it's 80 million. As usual, the mathematical approach is a formalized version of our natural mental reckonings, an extension of common sense by other means. A typical $80 million drawing might sell about 13 million tickets, but when Donald Lawson won 337 million, he was up against some 75 million other players. The more people who play, the more people win prizes. But there's only one jackpot. And if two people hit all 6 numbers, they have to share the big money. How likely is it that you'll win the jackpot and not have to share it? 2 things have to happen. First, you have to hit all 6 numbers. Your chance of doing so is 1 in 175 million. But it is not enough to win. Everyone else must lose. The chance of any particular player missing out on the jackpot is pretty good. Just about 174,999,999 in 175 million. But when 75 million other players are in the game, there starts to be a substantial chance one of those folks will hit the jackpot. How substantial? We use a fact we've already encountered several times, that if we know the probability that thing 1 happens, and we know the probability that thing 2 happens, and if the 2 things are independent, the occurrence of one has no effect on the likelihood of the other, then the probability of thing 1 and thing 2 happening is the product of the 2 probabilities. To abstract, let's do it with the lottery. There's a 174,999,999 in 175 million chance that I lose, and the same chance that my dad loses. So the probability that we both lose is that number times itself, or 99.999994%. In other words, as I tell my dad every single time, we'd better not quit our jobs. But what's the chance that all 75 million of your competitors lose? All I have to do is multiply the number by itself 75 million times. That sounds like an incredibly brutal detention assignment. But you can make the problem a lot simpler by phrasing it as an exponential, raising the number to the 75 millionth power. Your computer can calculate this for you instantaneously, getting 0.651. So there's a 65% chance that none of your fellow players will win, which means there's a 35% chance at least one of them will. If that happens, your share of the $337 million prize drops to a puny $168 million. That cuts the expected value of the jackpot to 65% times $337 million plus 35% times $168 million, or $278 million, which is just below the threshold value of $285 million that makes the jackpot worth it. And that doesn't even take into account the possibility that more than two people will hit the jackpot, divvying up the big prize even further. The possibility of jackpot splitting means the lottery ticket has an expected value less than what it costs you, even when the jackpot tops $300 million. If the jackpot were bigger still, the expected value might tip into the worth it zone. Or it might not, if the big jackpot attracted an even higher level of ticket sales. The biggest Powerball jackpot yet, $588 million, was won by two players, and the biggest lottery jackpot in U.S. history, a $688 million Mega Millions prize, was split three ways. And we haven't even considered the taxes you'll pay on your winnings, or the fact that the prize is distributed to you in yearly chunks. If you want all the money up front, you get a substantially smaller payout. And remember, the lottery is a creature of the state, and the state knows a lot about you. In many states, back taxes or other outstanding financial obligations get paid off from lottery winnings before you see a dime. An acquaintance who works at a state lottery told me the story of a man who came to the lottery office with his girlfriend to cash in his $10,000 ticket and spend a wild weekend on the town. When he turned in his ticket, the lottery official on duty told the couple that all but a few hundred dollars of the prize was already committed to delinquent child support the man owed his ex-girlfriend. This was the first the man's current girlfriend had heard of the man's child. The weekend did not go as planned. So what's your best strategy for making money playing Powerball? Here's my mathematically certified three-point plan. 1. Don't play Powerball. 2. If you do play Powerball, don't play Powerball unless the jackpot is really big. 3. And if you buy tickets for a massive jackpot, try to reduce the odds you'll have to share your haul. Pick numbers other players won't. Don't pick your birthday. Don't pick the numbers that won a previous draw. Don't pick numbers that form a nice pattern on the ticket. And for God's sake, don't pick numbers you find in a fortune cookie. You know they don't put different numbers in every cookie, right? Powerball isn't the only lottery, but all lotteries have one thing in common. They're bad bets. A lottery, just as Adam Smith observed, is designed to return a certain proportion of ticket sales to the state. For that to work, the state has to take in more money in tickets than it gives out in prizes. Turning that on its head, lottery players, on average, are spending more money than they win. So the expected value of a lottery ticket has to be negative. Except when it's not. The lottery scam that wasn't. On July 12, 2005, the compliance unit of the Massachusetts State Lottery received an unusual phone call from an employee at a Star Market in Cambridge, the northern suburb of Boston that houses both Harvard and MIT. A college student had come into the supermarket to buy tickets for the state's new cash windfall game. That wasn't strange. What was unusual was the size of the order. The student had presented 14,000 order slips, each one filled out by hand, for a total of $28,000 in lottery tickets. No problem, the lottery told the store. If the slips are filled out properly, anybody can play as much as they want. Stores were required to get a waiver from the lottery office if they wanted to sell more than $5,000 in tickets per day, but those waivers were easily granted. That was a good thing, because the Star wasn't the only Boston-area lottery agent doing a vigorous business that week. 12 more stores contacted the lottery in advance of the July 14th drawing to ask for waivers. 3 of those were concentrated in a heavily Asian-American neighborhood of Quincy, just south of Boston on the Bay Shore. Tens of thousands of cash windfall tickets were being sold to a small group of buyers at a handful of stores. What was going on? The answer wasn't secret. It was in plain sight, right there in the rules for cash windfall. The new game, launched in the fall of 2004, was a replacement for Mass Millions, which had been phased out after going an entire year without paying out a jackpot. Players were getting discouraged and sales were down. Massachusetts needed to shake up its lottery, and state officials hit on the idea of adapting Windfall, a game from Michigan. In Cash Windfall, the jackpot didn't pile higher and higher with each week it went unclaimed. Instead, every time the pot went over $2 million, the money rolled down to enhance the lesser prizes that weren't so hard to win. The jackpot reset to its minimum $500,000 value for the following drawing. The Lottery Commission hoped the new game, which made it possible to take in serious winnings without hitting the jackpot, would seem like a good deal. They did their job too well. In Cash Windfall, Massachusetts had inadvertently designed a game that actually was a good deal, and by the summer of 2005, a few enterprising players had figured that out. On a normal day, here's how the prize distribution for Cash Windfall looked. If you match all six numbers, so 1 in 9.3 million chance of that, you get the jackpot. Match 5 of 6, a 1 in 39,000 chance, a $4,000 prize. Match 4 of 6, a 1 in 800 chance, a $150 prize. Match 3 of 6, a 1 in 47 chance, a $5 prize. And matching 2 of 6, a 1 in 6.8 chance, and you get a free lottery ticket. If the jackpot is $1 million, the expected value of a $2 ticket is pretty poor. $1 million over $9.3 million, plus $4,000 over $39,000, plus $150 over $800, plus $5 over $47, plus $2 over $6.8, which is 79.8 cents. That's a rate of return so pathetic it makes Powerball players look like canny investors. And we've generously valued a free ticket at the $2 it would cost you instead of the substantially smaller expected value it brings you. But on a roll-down day, things look very different. On February 7th, 2005, the jackpot stood near $3 million. Nobody won that jackpot, unsurprising considering that only about 470,000 people played Cash Windfall that day, and matching all six numbers was about a 1 in 10 million long shot. So all that money rolled down. The state's formula rolled $600,000 to the Match 5 and Match 3 prize pools, and $1.4 million into the Match 4s. The probability of getting 4 out of 6 windfall numbers right is about 1 in 800, so there must have been about 600 match 4 winners that day out of the 470,000 players. That's a lot of winners, but $1.4 million is a lot of money. Dividing it into 600 pieces leaves more than $2,000 for each match 4 winner. In fact, you'd expect the payout for matching 4 out of 6 numbers that day to be around $2,385. That's a much more attractive proposition than the measly $150 you'd win on a normal day. A 1 in 800 chance of a $2,385 payoff has an expected value of $2,364 divided by 800, or $2.98. In other words, the Match 4 prize alone makes the ticket worth its $2 price. Throw in the other prizes, and the story gets even sweeter. The average ticket could be expected to bring home cash winnings of $5.53. An investment where you make $3.50 of profit on a $2 investment is not one to pass up. Of course, if one lucky person hits the jackpot, the game turns back into a pumpkin for everybody else. But Cash Windfall was never popular enough to make that outcome likely. Out of 45 roll-down days during the lifetime of the game, only once did a player match all six numbers and stop the roll-down in its tracks. Let's be clear. This computation doesn't mean that a $2 bet is sure to win you money. On the contrary, when you buy a Cash Windfall ticket on a roll-down day, your ticket is most likely a loser, just as it is on any other day. The expected value is not the value you expect. But on roll-down day, the prizes, in the unlikely event that you do win, are bigger, a lot bigger. The magic of expected value is that the average payout of 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 tickets is very likely to be close to $5.53. Any given ticket is probably worthless, but if you've got 1,000 tickets, it's essentially certain that you'll make your money back and then some. But who buys 1,000 lottery tickets at a time? Kids at MIT. That's who. The reason I can tell you the windfall payoffs on February 7th, 2005, down to the last dollar, is because this figure is recorded in the exhaustive and, frankly, kind of thrilling account of the Windfall Affair submitted to the state in July 2012 by Gregory W. Sullivan, the Inspector General of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I think I'm safe in saying this is history's only state fiscal oversight document which inspires the reader to wonder, does someone have the movie rights to this? And the reason it's this particular day for which this data is recorded is that February 7th was the first roll-down day after James Harvey, an MIT senior working on an independent study project comparing the merits of various state lottery games, realized that Massachusetts had accidentally created an insanely profitable investment vehicle for anyone quantitatively savvy enough to notice it. Harvey got a group of friends together. At MIT, it's not hard to get a group of friends together who can all compute expected value, and bought 1,000 tickets. Just as you might expect, one of those 1-in-800 shots came through, and Harvey's group took home one of the $2,000 prizes. They won a bunch of match threes, too. In all, they just about tripled their initial investment. It won't surprise you to hear that Harvey and his co-investors didn't stop playing Cash Windfall, or that he never did get around to finishing that independent study, at least not for course credit. In fact, his research project quickly developed into a thriving business. By summer, Harvey's confederates were buying tens of thousands of tickets at a time. It was a member of his group who placed the mammoth order at the Cambridge Star Market. They called their team Random Strategies, though their approach was anything but scattershot. The name referred to Random Hall, the MIT dorm where Harvey had originally cooked up his plan to make money on Windfall. And the MIT students weren't alone. At least two more betting clubs formed up to take advantage of the Windfall. Ying Zhang, a medical researcher in Boston with a PhD from Northeastern, formed the Dr. Zhang Lottery Club. It was the DZLC that accounted for the spike in sales in Quincy. Before long, the group was buying $300,000 worth of tickets for each roll-down. In 2006, Dr. Zhang quit doctoring to devote himself full-time to Cash Windfall. Still another betting group was led by Gerald Selby, a retiree in his 70s with a bachelor's degree in math. Selby lived in Michigan, the original home of Windfall. His group of 32 bettors, mostly made up of his relatives, played Windfall there for about 2 years until the game shut down in 2005. When Selby found out the gravy train was getting back on the tracks out east, his course was clear. In August 2005, he and his wife Marjorie drove to Deerfield in the western part of Massachusetts and placed their first bet, 60,000 tickets. They took home a little over $50,000 in pure profit. Selby, with the benefit of his experience playing the game in Michigan, added an extra profit-making venture to his Cash Windfall tickets. Stores in Massachusetts got a 5% commission on lottery ticket sales. Selby cut deals directly with one store, offering hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of business at a time in exchange for going halvesies on the 5% commission. That move alone made Selby's team thousands of dollars in extra profit every roll-down. You don't need an MIT degree to see how the influx of high-volume players affected the game. Remember, the reason the roll-down payoffs were so swollen was that a lot of money was being split among just a few winners. By 2007, a million or more tickets were being sold for each roll-down drawing, most of them to the three high-volume syndicates. The days of the $2,300 prize for matching 4 out of 6 numbers were long gone. If 1.5 million people bought tickets and one person in 800 matched 4, then you'd typically see almost 2,000 match 4 winners. So each share of the $1.4 million kitty was now more like $800. It's pretty easy to figure out how much a big player stood to gain from Cash Windfall. The trick is to look at it from the point of view of the lottery itself. If it's roll-down day, the state has at least $2 million of accumulated jackpot money it's got to get rid of. Let's say 1.5 million people buy tickets for the roll-down. That's $3 million more in revenue, of which 40% or $1.2 million goes into the state's coffers, and the other $1.8 million gets plowed into the jackpot fund, all of which is to be dispersed to bettors before the day is through. So the state takes in $3 million that day and hands out $3.8 million, $2 million from the money already in the jackpot fund, and $1.8 million from that day's ticket receipts. On any given day, whatever the state makes, the players, on average, lose, and vice versa. So this day is a good day to play. Ticket buyers, in the aggregate, took $800,000 from the state. If players buy 3.5 million tickets, it's a different story. Now the lottery takes $2.8 million as its share and pays out the remaining $4.2 million. On top of the $2 million already in the kitty, that amounts to $6.2 million, less than the $7 million of revenue the state took in. In other words, despite the generosity of the roll-down, the lottery has gotten so popular that the state still ends up making money at the expense of the players. This makes the state very, very happy. The break-even point comes when the 40% share of the roll-down day revenue exactly matches the $2 million already in the pot, that is, the money contributed by the players who were unsophisticated or risk-loving enough to play Windfall without a roll-down. That's $5 million, or 2.5 million tickets. More sales than that, and Windfall is a bad bet. But any fewer, and over the lifespan of the Windfall game, it always was fewer, and Windfall offers players a way to make some money. What we're really using here is a wonderful, while at the same time commonsensical, fact called additivity of expected value. Suppose I own a McDonald's franchise in a coffee shop, and the McDonald's has an expected annual profit of $100,000, while the coffee shop's expected net is $50,000. The money might go up and down from year to year, of course. The expected value means that, in the long run, the average amount of money the McDonald's makes will be about $100,000 a year, and the average amount from the coffee shop, $50,000. Additivity says that, on average, my total take from Big Macs and Mochaccinos together is going to average out to $150,000, the sum of the expected profits from each of my two businesses. In other words, the expected value of the sum of two things is the sum of the expected value of the first thing with the expected value of the second thing. Here's what this has to do with a lottery. The value of all the tickets in a given drawing is the amount of money handed out by the state, and that value isn't subject to uncertainty at all. It's just the amount of roll-down money, $3.8 million in the first example we discussed. The expected value of a sure $3.8 million is, well, just what you expect, $3.8 million. In that example, there were 1 million players on roll-down day. Additivity tells you that the sum of the expected values of all 1.5 million lottery tickets is the expected value of the total value of all the tickets, or $3.8 million. But each ticket, at least before you know what the winning numbers are, is worth the same. So you're summing 1.5 million copies of the same number and getting $3.8 million. That number must be $2.53. Your expected profit on your $2 ticket is 53 cents, more than 25% of your wager, a handsome profit on what's supposed to be a sucker's bet. The principle of additivity is so intuitively appealing that it's easy to think it's obvious, but just like the pricing of life annuities, it's not obvious. To see that, substitute other notions in place of expected value and watch everything go haywire. Consider, the most likely value of the sum of a bunch of things is the sum of the most likely values of each of the things. Well, that's totally wrong. Suppose I choose randomly which of my three children to give the family fortune to. The most likely value of each child's share is zero because there's a 2 in 3 chance I'm disinheriting them. But the most likely value of the sum of those three allotments, in fact, its only possible value, is the amount of my whole estate. Buffon's needle, Buffon's noodle, Buffon's circle. We have to interrupt the story of the college nerds versus the lottery for a minute, because once we're talking about additivity of expected value, I can't not tell you about one of the most beautiful proofs I know, which is based on the very same idea. It starts with a game of Franc Carreau, which, like the Genoese lottery, reminds you that people in olden times would gamble on just about anything. All you need for Franc Carreau is a coin and a floor with square tiles. You throw the coin on the floor and make a bet. Will it land wholly within one tile or end up touching one of the cracks? Franc Carreau translates roughly as squarely within the square. The coin used for this game was not a franc, which wasn't in circulation at the time, but the écu. Georges-Louis Leclerc, Comte de Buffon, was a provincial aristocrat from Burgundy who developed academic ambitions early on. He went to law school, perhaps with the aim of following his father into the magistracy, but as soon as he finished his degree, he threw aside legal matters in favor of science. By 1733, at the age of 27, he was ready to stand for membership in the Royal Academy of Sciences in Paris. Buffon would later gain fame as a naturalist, writing a massive 44-volume natural history that laid out his proposal for a theory intended to explain the origin of life as universally and parsimoniously as Newton's theory had explained motion and force. But as a young man, influenced by a brief meeting and long exchange of letters with the Swiss mathematician Gabriel Cramer, Buffon's interest lay in pure mathematics, and it was as a mathematician that he offered himself to the Royal Academy. The paper Buffon presented was an ingenious juxtaposition of two mathematical fields that had been thought of as separate, geometry and probability. Its subject wasn't a grand question about the mechanics of the planets and their orbits, or the economies of the great nations, but rather the humble game of Franck Carreau. What was the probability, Buffon asked, that the écu would land entirely within a single tile, and how large should the floor tiles be to make the game a fair bet for both players? Here's how Buffon did it. If the coin has radius r and the square tile has a side of length l, then the coin touches a crack exactly when its center lands outside a smaller square whose side has length l minus 2r. The smaller square has area l minus 2r quantity squared, while the bigger square has area l squared. So if you're betting on the coin landing squarely in the square, your chance of winning is the fraction l minus 2r quantity squared divided by l squared. For the game to be fair, this chance needs to be 1/2, which means that l minus 2r squared divided by l squared is 1/2. Buffon solved this equation, and so can you if that's the kind of thing you're into, finding that Franck Carreau was a fair game just when the side of the Carreau was 4 plus twice the square root of 2 times the radius of the coin, a ratio of just under 7. This was conceptually interesting in that the combination of probabilistic reasoning with geometric figures was novel, but it wasn't difficult, and Buffon knew it wouldn't be enough to get him into the academy, so he pressed forward, writing, "But if instead of throwing in the air a round piece as an écu, one would throw a piece of another shape as a squared Spanish pistole, or a needle, a stick, etc., the problem demands a little more geometry." This was an understatement. The problem of the needle is the one for which Buffon's name is remembered in mathematical circles even today. Let me explain it more precisely than Buffon did. The Buffon's needle problem. Suppose you have a hardwood floor made of long, skinny slats, and you happen to have in your possession a needle exactly as long as the slats are wide. Throw the needle on the floor. What's the chance that the needle crosses one of the cracks separating the slats? Here's why this problem is so touchy. When you throw the écu on the floor, it doesn't matter which direction Louis XV's face ends up pointing. A circle looks the same from every angle. The chance that it crosses a crack doesn't depend on its orientation. Buffon's needle is a different story. A needle oriented nearly parallel to the slats is very unlikely to cross a crack. But if the needle lands crosswise to the slats, it's almost certain to do so. The Franck Carreau is highly symmetric. In technical terms, we say it is invariant under rotation. In the needle problem, that symmetry has been broken, and that makes the problem much harder. We need to keep track of not just where the center of the needle falls, but also what direction it's pointing. In the two extreme cases, the chance the needle crosses a crack is 0 if the needle is parallel to the slat, or 1 if the needle and the crack are perpendicular. So you might split the difference and guess that the needle touches a crack exactly half the time. But that's wrong. In fact, the needle crosses a crack substantially more often than it lands wholly within a single slat. Buffon's needle problem has a beautifully unexpected answer. The probability is 2 over pi, or about 64%. Why pi when there's no circle in sight? Buffon found his answer using a somewhat intricate argument involving the area under a curve called the cycloid. Computing this area requires a bit of calculus, nothing a modern-day sophomore math major couldn't handle, but not exactly enlightening. But there's another solution, discovered by Joseph-Émile Barbier more than a century after Buffon's entry into the Royal Academy. No formal calculus is needed. In fact, you don't need computation of any kind. The argument, while a little involved, uses no more than arithmetic and basic geometric intuition. And the crucial point is, of all things, the additivity of expected value. The first step is to rephrase Buffon's problem in terms of expected value. We can ask, what is the expected number of cracks the needle crosses? The number Buffon aimed to compute was the probability P that the thrown down needle crosses a crack, Thus, there is a probability of 1 minus b that the needle doesn't cross any cracks. But if the needle crosses a crack, it crosses exactly 1. So expected number of crossings is obtained the same way we always compute expected value, by summing up each possible number of crossings multiplied by the probability of observing that number. In this case, the only possibilities are 0, observed with probability 1 minus p, and 1, observed with probability p. So we add up 1 minus p times 0, which is 0, and p times 1, which is p, and get p. So the expected number of crossings is simply p, the same number Buffon computed. We seem to have made no progress. How can we figure out the mystery number? When you're faced with a math problem you don't know how to do, you've got two basic options. You can make the problem easier, or you can make it harder. Making it easier sounds better. You replace the problem with a simpler one, solve that, and then hope that the understanding gained by solving the easier problem gives you some insight about the actual problem you're trying to solve. This is what mathematicians do every time we model a complex real-world system by a smooth, pristine mathematical mechanism. Sometimes this approach is very successful. If you're tracking the path of a heavy projectile, you can do pretty well by ignoring air resistance and thinking of the moving body as subject only to a constant force of gravity. Other times, your simplification is so simple that it eliminates the interesting features of the problem, as in the old joke about the physicist tasked with optimizing dairy production. He begins with great confidence, "Consider a spherical cow." In this spirit, one might try to get some ideas about Buffon's needle via the solution of the easier Francarot problem. Consider a circular needle. But it's not clear what useful information one can draw from a coin whose rotational symmetry robs it of the very feature that makes the needle problem interesting. Instead, we turn to the other strategy, which is the one Barbier used, make the problem harder. That doesn't sound promising, but when it works like a charm. Let's start small. What if we ask more generally about the expected number of crack crossings by a needle that's 2 slats wide? That sounds like a more complicated question, because now there are 3 possible outcomes instead of 2. The needle could land entirely within 1 slat, it could cross 1 crack, or it could cross 2. So to compute the expected number of crossings, it seems we'd have to compute the probability of 3 separate events instead of just 2. But thanks to additivity, this harder problem is easier than you think. Imagine a dot in the center of the long needle and label the 2 halves 1 and 2. Then the expected number of crossings on the long needle is just the sum of the expected number of crossings by half needle 1 and the expected number of crossings by half needle 2. In algebraic terms, if x is the number of cracks crossed by half needle 1 and y the number of cracks crossed by half needle 2, then the total number of cracks the long needle crosses is x plus y. But each of the 2 pieces is a needle of the length originally considered by Buffon. So each of those needles, on average, crosses the cracks p times. That is, the expected value of x and the expected value of y are both equal to p. Thus, the expected number of crossings of the whole needle is just the expected value of x plus the expected value of y, which is p plus p, or 2p. And the same reasoning applies to a needle of length 3, or 4, or 100 times the width of a slat. If a needle has length n, where we now take the width of a slat to be our unit of measure, its expected number of crossings is np. This works for short needles as well as long ones. Suppose I throw a needle whose length is 1/2, that is, it's just half as long as a slat is wide. Since Buffon's length 1 needle can be split into 2 length 1/2 needles, his expected value p must be twice the expected number of crossings on the length 1/2 needle. So the length 1/2 needle has 1/2 p expected crossings. In fact, the formula expected number of crossings of a length n needle equals np holds for any positive real number n, large or small. At this point, we've left rigorous proof behind. Some technical argument is necessary to justify why that statement is okay when n is some hideous irrational quantity like the square root of 2. But I promise you that the essential ideas of Barbier's proof are the ones I'm telling you now. Now comes a new angle, so to speak. Bend the needle. Consider a needle 5 slats long. But this needle is bent in 2 places, and I've closed the ends to form a triangle. The straight segments have length 1, 2, and 2, so the expected number of crossings on each segment is p, 2p, and 2p, respectively. The number of crossings on the whole needle is the sum of the number of crossings on each segment, so additivity tells us that the expected number of crossings on the whole needle is p plus 2p plus 2p, which is 5p. In other words, the formula expected number of crossings of a length n needle equals np holds for bent needles too. The needle could be a square, or an octagon, or a polygon with 65,536 sides. But we've heard this story before. It's the same story Archimedes and Eudoxus told 2 millennia ago when they were developing the method of exhaustion. Your eye can't tell the difference between a polygon with 65,536 sides and a circle, and neither can the floor, which means the expected number of crossings of the diameter 1 circle is just about exactly the same as the expected number of crossings of the 65,536 gone. And by our bent needle rule, that's NP, where N is the perimeter of the polygon. What's that perimeter? It must be almost exactly that of the circle. The circle has radius 1/2, so its circumference is pi. So the expected number of times the circle crosses a crack is pi p. How's making the problem harder working out for you? Doesn't it seem like we're making the problem more and more abstract and more general without ever addressing the fundamental issue, what is p? Well, guess what? We just computed it. Because how many crossings does the circle have? All of a sudden, what looked like a hard problem becomes easy. The symmetry we lost when we went from coin to needle has now been restored by bending the needle into a circular hoop. And this simplifies matters tremendously. It doesn't matter where the circle falls. It crosses the lines in the floor exactly twice. So the expected number of crossings is 2, and it is also pi p, and so we have discovered that p equals 2 divided by pi, just as Buffon said. In fact, this argument applies to any needle, however polygonal and curvy it might be. The expected number of crossings is Lp, where L is the length of the needle in slat-width units. Throw a mass of spaghetti on the tile floor, and I can tell you exactly how many times to expect a strand to cross a line. This generalized version of the problem is called, by mathematical wags, Buffon's noodle problem. The sea and the stone. Barbier's proof reminds me of what the algebraic geometer Pierre de Ligne wrote of his teacher, Alexander Grothendieck. Nothing seems to happen, and yet, at the end, a highly non-trivial theorem is there. Outsiders sometimes have an impression that mathematics consists of applying more and more powerful tools to dig deeper and deeper into the unknown, like tunnelers blasting through the rock with ever more powerful explosives. And that's one way to do it. But Grothendieck, who remade much of pure mathematics in his own image in the 1960s and 70s, had a different view. He wrote, "The unknown thing to be known appeared to me as some stretch of earth or hard marl, resisting penetration. The sea advances insensibly in silence. Nothing seems to happen. Nothing moves. The water is so far off you hardly hear it, yet it finally surrounds the resistant substance. The unknown is a stone in the sea which obstructs our progress. We can try to pack dynamite in the crevices of rock, detonate it, and repeat until the rock breaks apart, as Buffon did with his complicated computations in calculus. Or you can take a more contemplative approach, allowing your level of understanding gradually and gently to rise until after a time what appeared as an obstacle is overtopped by the calm water and is gone. Mathematics as currently practiced is a delicate interplay between monastic contemplation and blowing stuff up with dynamite." An aside on mathematicians and insanity. Barbier published his proof of Buffon's theorem in 1860 when he was just 21, a promising student at the École Normale Supérieure in Paris. By 1865, troubled by a nervous condition, he'd left town with no forwarding address. No mathematician saw him again until an old teacher of his, Joseph Bertrand, located him in a mental asylum in 1880. As for Grothendieck, he too left academic mathematics in the 1980s. He now lives in Salinger-esque seclusion somewhere in the Pyrenees. No one really knows what math he's working on, if any, Some say he herds sheep. These stories resonate with a popular myth about mathematics, that it drives you crazy or is itself a species of craziness. David Foster Wallace, the most mathematical of modern novelists, he once took a break from fiction to write a whole book about transfinite set theory, described the myth as the math melodrama and described its protagonist as a kind of Prometheus Icarus figure whose high-altitude genius is also hubris and fatal flaw. Movies like A Beautiful Mind, Proof, and Pi use math as a shorthand for obsession and flight from reality. And a best-selling murder mystery, Scott Turow's Presumed Innocent, turned on the twist that the hero's own wife, a mathematician, was actually the demented killer. In this case, the myth comes with a chaser of off-kilter sexual politics, the book's strong implication being that the difficulty of stretching a woman's brain onto a mathematical frame is what sent the murderess over the edge. You can find a more recent version of the myth in The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, in which mathematical ability presents itself as just another color in the autism spectrum. Wallace rejects this melodramatic picture of the mental life of mathematicians, and so do I. In real life, mathematicians are a pretty ordinary bunch, no madder than the average, and it's not actually very common for us to slink off into isolation to wage lonely battles in unforgiving abstract realms. Mathematics tends to strengthen the mind rather than strain it to its breaking point. If anything, I've found that in moments of emotional extremity, there is nothing like a math problem to quiet the complaints the rest of the psyche serves up. Math, like meditation, puts you in direct contact with the universe, which is bigger than you, was here before you, and will be here after you. It might drive me crazy not to do it. Trying to make it roll. Meanwhile, in Massachusetts, the more people played cash windball, the less profitable it was. Each big purchaser who entered the game split the prizes into more pieces. At one point, Gerald Selby told me, Yuron Liu from Random Strategies suggested that they and the Selby group agree to take turns playing the roll downs, guaranteeing each group a higher profit margin. Selby paraphrased Yuron's proposal as, "You're a big player, I'm a big player, we can't control these other players who are fleas in our hair." By cooperating, Selby and Liu could at least control each other. The plan made sense, but Selby didn't bite. He was comfortable with exploiting a quirk in the game, since the rules of the game were public, just as available to any other player as they were to him. But colluding with other players, though it's not clear this would have violated any lottery rules, felt too much like cheating. So the cartels settled into an equilibrium, all three pouring money into every roll-down drawing. With the high-volume bettors buying 1.2 to 1.4 million tickets a drawing, Selby estimated that lottery tickets on roll-down days had an expected value of just 15% more than their cost. That's still a pretty nice profit. But Harvey and his confederates weren't satisfied. The life of a professional lottery winner isn't the cartoon of leisure you might imagine. For Harvey, running Random Strategies was a full-time job, and not a particularly fulfilling one. Before roll-down day, tens of thousands of lottery tickets had to be purchased and bubbled in by hand. On the day itself, Harvey had to manage the logistics of multiple team members scanning all those slips at the convenience stores that agreed to handle the team's mega-purchases. And after the winning numbers were announced, there was still the long slog of sifting the winning tickets from the worthless losers. Not that you could throw the losing tickets in the trash. Harvey saved those in storage boxes, because when you win the lottery a lot, the IRS audits you a lot, and Harvey needed to be able to document his gambling activities. Gerald Selby still has 20-some plastic laundry tubs full of losing lottery tickets, about $18 million worth, occupying the back of a pole barn on his property. The winning tickets required some effort, too. Each member of the group had to fill out an individual W-2G tax form for each drawing, no matter how small their share. Does it sound like fun yet? The Inspector General estimated that Random Strategies made $3.5 million before taxes over the 7-year life of cash windfall. We don't know how much of that money went to James Harvey, but we do know he bought a new car. It was a used 1999 Nissan Altima. The good times, the early days of cash windfall, when you could double your money with ease, weren't so far in the past, Surely, Harvey and his team wanted to get back there. But how could they, with the Selby family and the Dr. Jong Lottery Club buying up hundreds of thousands of tickets for every roll-down drawing? The only time the other high-volume bettors took a break was when the jackpot wasn't large enough to trigger the roll-down. But Harvey, too, sat those drawings out, for a good reason. Without the roll-down money, the lottery was a crappy bet. On Friday, August 13th, 2010, the lottery projected the jackpot for the next Monday's drawing at $1.675 million, well short of the roll-down threshold. The Jong and Selby cartels were quiet, waiting for the jackpot to creep up over the roll-down level. But Random Strategies made a different play. Over the previous months, they'd quietly prepared hundreds of thousands of extra tickets, waiting for a day when the projected jackpot was close to $2 million, but not quite there. This was the day. And over the weekend, their members fanned across Greater Boston, buying up more tickets than anyone had before, around 700,000 in all. With the unexpected infusion of cash from Random Strategies, the jackpot on Monday, August 16th, stood at $2.1 million. It was a roll-down, payday for lottery players, and nobody except the MIT students knew it was coming. Almost 90% of the tickets for the drawing were held by Harvey's team. They were standing in front of the money spigot, all alone. And when the drawing was over, Random Strategies had made $700,000 on their $1.4 million investment, a cool 50% profit. This trick wasn't going to work twice. Once the lottery realized what had happened, they put an early warning system in place to notify top management if it looked like one of the teams was trying to push the jackpot over the roll-down line single-handedly. When Random Strategies tried again in late December, the lottery was ready. On the morning of December 24th, 3 days before the drawing, the chief of staff of the lottery got an email from his team saying, "Cash windfall guys are trying to make it roll again." If Harvey was betting on the lottery being off duty for the holiday, he wagered wrong. Early Christmas morning, the lottery updated its estimated jackpot to announce to the world that a roll down was coming. The other cartels, still smarting from their August snookering, canceled their Christmas vacations and bought hundreds of thousands of tickets, bringing profits back down to normal levels. At any rate, the game was almost up. Sometime shortly afterward, a friend of Boston Globe reporter Andrea Estes noticed something funny in the 2020 list of winners that the lottery makes public. There were a lot of people in Michigan winning prizes, and they were all winning one particular game, cash windfall. Did Estes think there was anything to it? Once the Globe started asking questions, the whole picture quickly came clear. On July 31st, 2011, the Globe ran a front-page story by Estes and Scott Allen explaining how the three betting clubs had been monopolizing the cash windfall prizes. In August, the lottery changed the rules of windfall, capping at $5,000 the total ticket sales any individual retailer could disperse in a day, effectively blocking the cartels from making their high-volume purchases. But the damage was done. If the point of cash windfall was to seem like a better deal for ordinary players, the game was now pointless. The last windfall drawing, fittingly a roll-down, was held on January 23rd, 2012. If gambling is exciting, you're doing it wrong. James Harvey wasn't the first person to take advantage of a poorly designed state lottery. Gerald Selby's group made millions on Michigan's original windfall game before the state got wise and shut it down in 2005. And the practice goes back much further. In the early 18th century, France financed government spending by selling bonds, but the interest rate they offered wasn't enticing enough to drive sales. To spice the pot, the government attached a lottery to the bond sales. Every bond gave its holder the right to buy a ticket for a lottery with a 500,000 livre prize, enough money to live on comfortably for decades. But Michel Lepelletier de Fort, the deputy finance minister who conceived the lottery plan, had botched the computations. The prizes to be dispersed substantially exceeded the money to be gained in ticket receipts. In other words, the lottery, like cash windfall on roll-down days, had a positive expected value for the players, and anyone who bought enough tickets was due for a big score. One person who figured this out was the mathematician and explorer Charles-Marie de la Condamine. Just as Harvey would do almost three centuries later, he gathered his friends into a ticket-buying cartel. One of these was the young writer François-Marie Arouet, better known as Voltaire. While he may not have contributed to the mathematics of the scheme, Voltaire placed his stamp on it. Lottery players were to write a motto on their ticket to be read aloud when a ticket won the jackpot. Voltaire, characteristically, saw this as a perfect opportunity to epigrammatize, writing cheeky slogans like "All men are equal" and "Long live